So our second reading is on page 1069, John 1. So we're continuing our series looking at Jesus in Genesis. And we're looking at lots of verses and passages as we have been in this series. And inside the service sheet is an outline of where we're going. Page 1069, John 1, verse 35. The next day again, John was standing with two of his disciples, and he looked at Jesus as he walked by and said, "Behold, the Lamb of God." The two disciples heard him say this, and they followed Jesus. And Jesus turned and saw them following him and said to them, "What are you seeking?" And they said to him, "Rabbi," which means teacher, where are you staying?" And he said to them, "Come and you'll see." So they came and they saw where he was staying, and they stayed with him that day, for it was about the 10th hour. One of the two who heard John speak and followed Jesus was Andrew, Simon Peter's brother. He first found his own brother Simon and said to him, "We have found the Messiah," which means Christ. And he brought him to Jesus, and Jesus looked at him and said, "So you are Simon, the son of John. You shall be called Cephas," which means Peter. The next day Jesus decided to go to Galilee. He found Philip and said to him, "Follow me." Now Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. Philip found Nathanael and said to him, "We have found him of whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." Nathanael said to him, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" Philip said to him, "Come and see." Jesus saw Nathanael coming towards him and said of him, "Behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom there is no deceit." Nathanael said to him, "How do you know me?" Jesus answered him, "Before Philip called you, when you were under the fig tree, I saw you." Nathanael answered him, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." And Jesus answered him, "Because I said to you, I saw you under the fig tree, do you believe? You will see greater things than these." And he said to him, "Truly, truly, I say to you, you will see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man." How amazing do you find the stars and the galaxies up there in space? Depends on what you see, what you can see. So if I'm here in London going on an evening dog walk, I barely notice the stars and the galaxies up there. So, you know, the odd star peeks through, but it's just this little pinprick of light. If, however, I'm over in Sweden on a clear night, no light pollution, the night sky is pretty impressive. And we sometimes lie down outside and we do some stargazing, you know, get the mattresses out and so on. But better than any of this, when you look at these photos produced by NASA, taken by their space telescopes, it's absolutely stunningly breathtaking. Then we see what's out there, we see it up close in glorious technicolor. And I put a few examples on the screen just to give you an idea of what these pictures are like from NASA, and they're even better probably on your home computer than through our projector. But there we go, check them out yourself later. Now, it's a little bit like this with Jesus. How amazing do we find him to be? How is it for you? For some people, Jesus is like a distant star. It's like this pinprick in the sky that I see on the dog walk. We hardly notice it as we sort of go about our busy lives. For other people, he's pretty impressive, you know, like the night sky over in Sweden, which is good. But you might think, well, if only we could see him more as he really is, with sort of NASA-quality pictures, then we would be utterly wowed by him. And then there'd be no question at all that this person deserves my soul, my life, my all. There's a short ancient prayer which says this. It says, "Day by day, dear Lord, three things I pray. To see thee more clearly, to love thee more dearly, to follow thee more nearly day by day. And that is a good prayer, isn't it? But how? How do we see the Lord more clearly? Part of the answer is, read the Old Testament. Which may come as a surprise, because we might think, well, the obvious place to go to see Jesus more clearly is the gospel accounts. I mean, surely it's in the gospel accounts that we see Jesus walking and talking and teaching and living and doing. And obviously that's really important. But if we want the sort of NASA quality pictures, we need the Old Testament as well. The Old Testament is not some dull history of Israel. The Old Testament is about Jesus. It points forward to him. And that actually really hits you in the face when you read the gospel accounts. I mean, right from the beginning of the gospel accounts, it's obvious that they're about that the Old Testament points to them. So if you read these gospel accounts, they all begin with the Old Testament. And they're steeped in the Old Testament. And if you've never read any of the Old Testament, I think you'd be struggling. So just if you go, you know, go home later and just read the first chapter of each of the four Gospels. Matthew 1:1, very first verse says, Jesus is the son of David, the son of Abraham. We think, well, who are they? You know, what have they got to do with anything? Mark chapter 1, verse 2, as it is written in Isaiah the prophet. Luke 1:32, the Lord will give him the throne of his father David, and he will reign over the house of Jacob forever. And as I just read in John chapter 1, verse 45, we have found him, of whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth. If I said, as I often do, I have found my glasses, it implies that I was looking for them. When Jesus began his public ministry, people said, we found him. Found him? Who were they looking for? Well, they were looking for the one that Moses and the prophets wrote about. As Jesus said of himself in the Old Testament scriptures, they bear witness about me. But how do they do that? That's what we're exploring in Genesis. We saw last week that Adam, the first man, he points to, he foreshadows Jesus, the second man, the last Adam, in all sorts of ways. But where else is Jesus in Genesis? That's what we're continuing to look at today. And the aim is that we would see him more clearly, love him more dearly, follow him more nearly, day by day. So, where does Jesus first appear in Genesis? What would you say? Right in the first few verses. Genesis 1 verse 1, the Bible begins, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. To which we say, well, I must be missing something because I can't see him. Now, this is different to what we saw last week with Adam. We saw last week that Adam was a type of Christ, a foreshadowing of Christ. What we have here in the creation account is not that. Instead, Christ is actually there, though not immediately apparent in the text. Maybe think of it this way, that if you take a photo of space, what you see on that picture depends on the camera. Different cameras pick up different wavelengths. So visible light, a light which the human eye can see, is only one small, very narrow part of the electromagnetic spectrum. And the other light is there, but the wavelengths are either too large or they're too small for our eyes to see, unaided. But if you've got an infrared camera, it can see it, can reveal it. And so with this, John chapter 1 is a rerun of this Genesis creation account, but using, if you like, a different spec camera. And it reveals other details which are there, but which just didn't show up with the Genesis camera. So John 1 begins, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him. And then the account goes on to say the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. So Jesus was there in the beginning, the eternal Word who was with God and who was God, the one through whom God made everything. He was there. I mean, the Son is, Hebrews 1 says, he's the one through whom God created the world. Or 1 Corinthians 8 says, there is one Lord, Jesus Christ, through whom are all things and through whom we exist. Colossians 1, by him all things were created. All things were created through him and for him. Now, the New Testament camera enables us to see this. But are there any hints of it in the Genesis account? Well, there's certainly plurality within the Godhead. That's certainly there. Genesis 1 mentions God and the Spirit of God. And then 1:26 of Genesis says, God says, let us make man. And then when the Lord appears to Abraham later in Genesis 18, when he appears to Abraham, three men are standing there, which is interesting. Little hints, perhaps. Now, seeing that Jesus was there at creation, that he is the eternal Word, is mind-blowing. What must it have been like for John, that first disciple John, when this penny dropped? What must it have been like for him? The other week, Reuben had a day out in Norfolk with some friends, and the people that he stayed with, they invited over one of their neighbours for dinner. And it turns out that this neighbour is a pilot, but he's not just any old pilot. He's an F-35 fighter pilot. Now, the F-35, just in case you don't know, the most advanced fighter jet in the world, these pilots are the elite of the elite. Okay, this is Top Gun with afterburners on. And this guy, he flew over at the coronation. He's in one of those F-35s at coronation. And Reuben spent the evening chatting with him. And this guy gave him his number at the end. And I would have been a total fanboy in that situation, I can tell you. But who is the most special person you've ever met? I mean, wouldn't you hang on their every word? Wouldn't you be telling everyone about him? Well, Jesus is not just a fighter pilot. He's the eternal Word. And just imagine the Apostle John going home one day and saying to his family over dinner, I met someone the other day through whom the universe was created. For real. You know, I'm absolutely convinced he's the eternal Word of God become flesh. And he is the shining light. He's the shining light. The first thing God said at creation was, let there be light, Genesis 1:3. And if you were reading that account with Jesus, he would be saying, that's me. That's me. That's me there. That's me. Jesus said, I'm the light of the world. John 1 says of the eternal Word, the light shines in the darkness and the darkness has not overcome it. The true light was coming into the world. Back in the beginning, the universe was a dark, lifeless place. But through the eternal Word, God brought light and he brought life. And what he did then in the beginning, it anticipates what he would later do in history by sending his Son into this spiritually dark and lifeless world to bring light and to bring life. Imagine you were lost in some dark woods at night and all you've got is a little box of matches. And it's windy. You've only got a few matches left. It's completely hopeless. You know, what you need in that situation is you need the sun to come up and a new day to dawn pretty quickly. Well, this world is a very, very dark place ruled over by sin and death. And a box of matches is not going to help very much. And it's soon going to run out. And then all that is left is, in the famous words of Dylan Thomas in his poem, to rage, rage against the dying of the light as we get older and we face death. Forget the matches. We need something better than that. And better is what God has sent. Isaiah 9:2. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. those who dwelt in a land of deep darkness, on them the light has shined. There he is again in the Old Testament, Jesus, the light of the world. And this light of Christ, it not only shines on us, but it shines in us when we receive him. 2 Corinthians 4 says, "For God who said, 'Let light shine out of darkness,' has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ." So he's saying that when we receive Christ, he brings light and life to our dark hearts. So not just an external light shining on us, but internal light shining in us and through us. And then as children of light, as Ephesians 5 says, full of hope, we head for the heavenly city in which there is no sun and there is no moon, but there's no night because its lamp is the Lamb, Revelation 21 says. The next place we find Jesus in Genesis is in a specific promise. After the disobedience of Adam and Eve, God addressed with words of judgment the three parties involved in turn: the serpent, the woman, the man. He cursed the serpent, and God said this to him: "I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel." So the serpent and the woman and their offspring would be at war from that point onwards. And in the end, it was saying that the offspring of the woman would bruise the serpent's head, but would suffer in the process. Now, bruise is a possible translation of that word, but the Hebrew verb can also mean to strike at or to crush. And that's how it's translated, for example, in Job 9:17. Job says, "He crushes me with a tempest," same word, this bruise word. Now, what is this referring to? Is it just predicting that people and snakes are not going to get on very well? I mean, certainly most of us have a pretty difficult relationship with snakes. You come across the odd person who keeps a snake as a pet, but, you know, kind of odd in both senses, we would say, you know, unusual and strange. I mean, the normal response, the normal reaction is to run away screaming hysterically. I think that's normal. My wife can't even look at a snake. I have no great affection for them either, I have to say. And over the years, to protect the family, I may or may not have had to kill a snake or two. How big were they, you say? Big. Let's not get hung up on details. Let's just say they're big. And poisonous. Probably. I didn't want to take a chance on that one. It's got nothing to do with snake phobias and heroics in Scandi forests. This is about something much, much bigger. The serpent, of course, in Genesis 3 is the devil. It's Satan. And this is a promise that one day someone would come who would finally defeat this enemy of God and humanity, the serpent crusher. But, it says, his victory would come at a price. He would suffer. The serpent would strike or crush his heel. Now, Jesus obviously is the fulfillment of this ancient promise. That in Jesus, the serpent crusher has come. So Jesus is the offspring of the woman. That's how he's called in Galatians 4. It says God sent forth his son, born of woman. And the point is that the Son of God, he didn't just come from heaven to earth to appear in his sort of heavenly state. He became a human being. He was born of woman. That was the ancient promise, wasn't it? That the serpent crusher would be an offspring of Eve, born of woman, not just some visiting spirit, but he would be flesh and blood. Why was Jesus sent into the world? Well, to crush the serpent. 1 John 4 says, the reason the Son of God appeared was to destroy the works of the devil and ultimately to destroy the devil himself. Now, that is fantastic news for humanity. Was there a bully at your school? Yep, there wasn't mine. Every school seems to have one. This nasty kid who's bigger than everyone else makes life pretty miserable for other people. When we get older, we discover that there are still plenty of grown-up bullies in the playground, at work, and on the international stage. And then we start to learn that there is also an ultimate bully, spiritual bully, the devil, the enemy of mankind. He's powerful. He's evil. He hates people. He makes life miserable for us. He wants to destroy us. We can't deal with him. He is far, far too big for any of us. And we think, well, if only there was someone stronger, someone bigger to take him on. There is. The Son of God. That's why he's come. So right at the beginning of his public ministry, there is this showdown between the Son and the serpent, the temptation of Jesus in the desert, and Jesus comes out the winner. And then in his ministry, he demonstrated his authority over the devil by casting out demons. And then on the cross, he defeated him. John 12, Jesus said, "Now will the ruler of this world be cast out." And he, as Colossians 2 says, he disarmed the rulers and authorities, triumphing over them. And when the Son returns, he will, 1 Corinthians 15 says, he will put all his enemies under his feet. And the devil himself will be thrown into the lake of fire. The head of the serpent, finally crushed. The end of evil. So Genesis 3:15, it's not about us. Certainly not in the first place about us. It's about Jesus. And if we read ourselves into this text, we'll think, you know, we can take on the devil ourselves and defeat him, you know, through discipline, through doing our best, through being good, through trying harder. We can't. It's a total mismatch. What chances would you have out at sea, in the water, up against an orca killer whale? Well, more chance than you'd have against the devil. This is not about us. This is about Jesus. We are not the hero of the story. He is. It's not about us killing snakes. It's about Jesus crushing the serpent. And then as those in him, we will one day share in his victory. So Romans 16 says, "The God of peace will soon crush Satan under your feet," speaking to believers. And so today, let's give thanks for the serpent crusher and for the price he paid for the victory. Do you remember the promise? The promise was that the serpent would bruise his heel, and he did. So Jesus won, but only at the cost of intense suffering. And that cost is highlighted in the next place we find Jesus in Genesis, in the person of Abel. Genesis 4, Adam and Eve had two sons, Cain and Abel, and they brought offerings to God, and God accepted Abel's but not Cain's, and Cain became very angry. And the Lord warned him, the Lord said to him, "Look, sin is crouching at the door, its desire is for you, but you must rule over it." But he didn't. He was overcome by sin. He killed his brother. We have the first murder. With Adam's disobedience in the garden, sin and death entered the world. And Adam saw this worked out in his own family. And this Cain and Abel episode is a desperately sad story about family breakdown and anger, killing, violence, injustice. And it is a story that has been repeated many, many times since. I mean, this is life in a fallen world. And this grim tale warns us to expect that. And in particular, it warns us to expect to suffer as believers because Abel was a man of faith. Hebrews 11:4 tells us that. It says, "By faith, Abel offered to God a more acceptable sacrifice than Cain, through which he was commended as righteous." So through faith, Abel was a righteous man, and he suffered for it, as many believers have since. So what's our take home from the tale? We might say, well, don't be like Cain. Instead, be like Abel, a man of faith, but expect you're going to suffer for it. And, you know, those things are true. But this story isn't just about us. It's about Jesus. As a righteous man who is unjustly killed, Abel foreshadows Jesus. So when we get to Matthew 23, Jesus is condemning the Pharisees, whose forefathers shed the blood of the prophets, and he says this. He says to them, "You are sons of those who murdered the prophets." And he predicts that they're going to do the same, killing and crucifying the prophets sent to them, obviously alluding to what they're about to do to him, killing him. And he tells them that they will be held accountable for all the righteous blood shed on earth, from the blood of innocent Abel to the blood of Zechariah. So Jesus saw his fate foreshadowed in that of Abel. Abel was the first innocent man whose righteous blood was shed, the first of many in biblical history, the first of a long line culminating in Jesus, the ultimate innocent man whose righteous blood was shed. Shed by religious people who are on the wrong side of God. But with Jesus, there is a difference. There is a big difference. Hebrews 12:24. It says that as Christians, we have come to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. A better word. So Abel's blood cried out to the Lord from the ground in Genesis 4. What did it cry out? Well, presumably, it cried out for justice to be done. But the blood of Jesus speaks a better word. It cries out that justice has been done, that Jesus has suffered the judgment we deserve in our place, and that through faith in his shed blood, we are now cleansed and we're forgiven and we're reconciled to God. Now, that is a much better word. We saw last week, didn't we, that Adam was a type of Jesus. He was a foreshadowing. He was pointing to him. So is Abel. And with a type, I think I mentioned this last week, with a type there is both analogy and escalation. And what we mean by that is that what it points to is similar, analogy, but it's better, escalation. In 1903... the Wright brothers flew the first successful powered airplane called the Wright Flyer. And I put a little picture on the screen of the Wright Flyer. There it is in all its glory. Now, to quote from the website of the National Air and Space Museum, it says, "While aviation technology has developed a lot since then, not much about the basic components of an aircraft has changed." Interesting. Okay, so an Airbus A380 has got the same basic features as this thing. It's got wings, it's got body, it's got engine, and it flies. It's an Airbus. It's kind of similar, but it is a good deal better. So a prototype like that, it shows you the shape of what is to come, but what comes later is better. And it's the same with Jesus. That Abel was the Wright Flyer, Jesus is the Airbus. And so Jesus is not just like Abel, he's the better Abel, he's the greater Abel. His blood speaks a better word. He's not just like Adam, he's the greater Adam. And he is the greater David and Solomon and Temple and so on. So as Jesus says in Matthew 12, he says, "Something greater than the temple is here. Something greater than Jonah is here. Something greater than Solomon is here." It's him. So we've got analogy, but escalation. The greater has come. And that is something for which we should be very, very thankful. Would you rather take a flight on the Wright Flyer or the Airbus? Exactly. You know, we have it so much better now that the greater has come. We are very, very fortunate to have Jesus and the blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. So where do we see Jesus in Genesis? He is the eternal Word through whom everything was made. He is the serpent crusher born of the woman. He is the righteous man whose blood was shed. And as we saw last week, he's the second Adam. And we're still in the up to chapter 4. So this is going to be a long series. There's a lot of Jesus in Genesis. We'll continue our journey next week. But for now, as we close, let's just go back for a moment to NASA. We're thinking at the beginning about NASA-quality photos of space. Now, that is what we want of Jesus. We want to see him clearly in all his glory. How do we get that? Well, how do they get such amazing shots? And the answer is composite pictures. Composite pictures. What they do is they combine multiple images, sometimes from different telescopes. So I was looking at some amazing shots this week, which combine pictures taken by two telescopes. You've got the James Webb Space Telescope. You've got the Hubble Space Telescope. And the pictures combined are absolutely stunning. And the write-up about it said this. The resulting panchromatic image combines visible and infrared light to assemble one of the most comprehensive views of the universe ever taken. The image reveals a wealth of details that are only possible to capture by combining the power of both space telescopes. It's exactly what we need with Jesus. That to get the best view of Jesus, we need to combine the power of both telescopes, of the New Testament and of the Old Testament. We need the kind of panchromatic, detailed, comprehensive image that only comes from combining old and new. We need this composite picture that's made up of multiple views from both telescopes. And only then will we see Jesus as he really is. And then instead of him just being a sort of distant pinprick star or a sort of pretty impressive night sky, instead he will be breathtaking. And we will go from saying, mm-hmm, to saying, wow, as we see Jesus as he really is. The Jesus who deserves our life, our soul, our all. And as we see him more clearly, what will happen? We will love him more dearly and follow him more nearly day by day. We're going to pause for a moment and reflect on this. And then Helen's going to lead us in prayer. Before that, we're going to listen to a version of this ancient prayer being sung by Shirley Bassey. A classic from back when I was a kid. No. So we're going to take it. It goes on a bit. So we'll listen for a couple of minutes. But let's take the opportunity to reflect on it and to pray that the Lord would help us to see Jesus more clearly.